You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
My guest is Laurie R. King. She is the award-winning author of many books, including a series of novels featuring Detective Kate Martinelli, a series featuring Mary Russell, partner of Sherlock Holmes, and many others. Her brand new book is Back to the Garden. Laurie R. King, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you so much.
It's really a pleasure to meet you, and I've admired your work for a long time.
Thank you.
Now, I really loved Back to the Garden. It was wonderful.
Okay.
And I want you, I know it's whenever we talk to mystery writers, we don't want to give anything away. So I'll let you tell our listeners what they should know about Back to the Garden.
What they should know. Briefly, it is a story in two timelines. Current timeline has Inspector Raquel Lang, who is with the San Francisco Police Department. And she is in charge of a cold case that comes literally to light in an estate down the San Francisco Peninsula, that they soon realize the body was laid there nearly 50 years ago at a time when the estate was a commune. So I have lots of fun with it. And especially those people who are listening to this in Santa Cruz, I mean, it'll sound like old home week, right?
That's how I felt. So it's not only a whodunit, it's a who did they do it to? It's really interesting to read about the 1970s and the way people are, because it doesn't seem like very long ago to me. It seems like we were just there.
It's hard to think of it as being a partly historical book, isn't it? And it's always interesting to do research about, you know, your own past. Because you forget things and you think, I mean, the book is set in part during, it sort of spans the 70s. There's a little bit of it that takes place in 72 when one of the characters comes back from Vietnam. There's another section of it that is 75 when they establish the commune in this estate. But the bulk of the past timeline, the then timeline, is 1979. And I had forgotten until I started dwelling on it again, how much that late 70s was a sort of interim time. I mean, you sort of think of everything as being the 60s, right? And we were all long-haired hippies and the rest. But 1979 was on the edge of, I mean, we were doing disco. We had women in large shoulder pads, you know, and so 1979 is this interesting period between the flower power era and the much less enthusiastic and optimistic era of the 80s. So that's always, from a writer's point of view, it's always more interesting to set a book in a time that's not just one thing, that you have this transition, and especially if the reader has been there or who knows it, you know what's coming, and you know that it's not the 60s anymore.
Well, it is nice the way music kind of permeates your book. I mean, even the title, Back to the Garden.
Yeah.
I appreciated that. And rock stars occasionally show up in your book.
Yeah, yeah. And again, music was so much a part of the time. One of the things that they asked me to do for this book was, a lot of book clubs like to have a sort of kit that they do with suggestions for discussion questions, silly pictures that may show things to do with the story. And one of the things that Random House asked me for was a music list so that they can make a Spotify playlist on it. And I got to tell you, you know, that was tough winnowing it down to, you know, 30 songs, because, man, that was a time for music, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, absolutely. One of our favorite times. But I guess you could do the same thing. I mean, I don't know, it'd probably be harder to do it in the era before recorded music. But if you wrote a novel in the 30s or 40s or 20s, I mean, there would be, music would be a rich part of it then too.
Yeah. And of course, in the 20s to 40s, it's very much indicative of subgroups. So that in the 20s, for example, you have the kind of the flapper groups who are listening to one set of music, but you have the older or more established people who had a whole different set of popular music that they would listen to that had nothing to do with Yes, We Have No Bananas.
Well, I have a younger cousin, he's maybe 50, and he talks about the tyranny of classic rock. And what he's referring to is that when I was a kid and the oldies station was on, they would play music from the 50s. And then that oldies station kind of graduated to playing music from the 60s and 70s. So you would think that today an oldies station would play music from the 90s or the 2000s, but they don't. Oldies stations still play music from the 60s and 70s. The 60s and 70s became the music of the past forever, or at least for a long time.
Yeah. When you're talking about classical rock, that is 60s and 70s. So yeah.
Yeah. And it's as if music from the 80s or 90s, you know, never existed. At least they don't have that same kind of canon that music from the 60s and 70s had.
It divides up, doesn't it? Because you have the disco and the heavy metal and it's no longer under an umbrella.
Yeah. Well, when you mentioned about doing research for a novel like this, what kind of research did you do?
Oh, well, I think a lot of stuff that had to do with the communes, because I mean, well, I always lived around communes. I never actually lived on one. So it was nice to have books and photographic essays that had to do with commune life and reminded me what people looked like. I mean, for one thing, they were all so clean. You forget how clean people were in the 60s and 70s. I mean, women wore their hair long, but it was always shiny, always shiny. And very few people had piercings or tattoos. I mean, that was really not a thing you got until much later.
Yeah, yeah.
And you forget, because you kind of think, well, alternative lifestyles, sure, grunge and tattoos and pierced noses and things. And I mean, those would have been really thought of as weird. Occasionally you'd have a man who had a tattoo, but usually it was somebody who'd been in the army and had decided to become a long hair instead. I mean, there's a couple of really excellent books that are set around the time to help serve as reminders. I was born in 1952, so I was in my 20s during the 70s. And most of us are kind of busy with getting our lives together. And I was at school and then grad school and the rest of it. So I wasn't really paying a lot of attention to people that weren't right around me, immediately around me all the time. And it was nice to have a book like Hippie Woman Wild to remind me that's, you know, that's how some of us lived during the 70s. So it was the kind of research that's more evocative than anything else.
Well, now, you mentioned college. You're a Bay Area native, and you went to UC Santa Cruz, didn't you?
Yep. Yeah. I'm a slug. Go slugs. Yeah.
And where did you do your graduate work?
Well, I finished at UCSC in the mid-70s, and I went up to Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley and did a degree in a master's degree in Old Testament, which Old Testament is interesting because it's storytelling. And people think, oh, weird thing to go from a theological degree to writing mysteries. But in fact, it's not that far removed because the Old Testament is all about stories. And it's all about the details in stories that tell you important things between the lines, as it were. So it's actually remarkably applies to the work of a storyteller.
And there are a lot of murders in the Old Testament, if I'm not wrong.
Yeah.
Even in chapter one.
Yeah, right. So. Yeah, and that's, I sort of get to work these things into books so that the title of this one, Back to the Garden, yes, I think for most of certainly older readers will immediately think of Woodstock and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young and the rest of it. But it also has to do with Eden and how two people who were setting up communes in the 60s and 70s, they were reshaping the world. They were creating an Eden that was perfect to their minds. And then you have the venomous snake coming in the side. You also have this image of the Cain and Abel, which again, not going into the details of the book, but you begin to suspect that early murder from the Old Testament may have not been altogether that out of touch with modern life.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking this week with Lori R. King, the New York Times bestselling author. She's the author of a brand new book. It's called Back to the Garden. We'll have more with Lori R. King right after this. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We're chatting this week with Lori R. King here on KSCO. Lori King's new book is Back to the Garden.
When you were a student in the 70s and then in Berkeley and Santa Cruz, were you thinking about murder? When did murder become a thing that, you've written a lot of books and I think there are murders in most of them.
I think there's one or two that I forgot to put a dead body in, but for the most part there, because I write mysteries and adult mysteries tend to be on issues that really matter. That is the taking of a life. Not so much young adult or certainly not middle grade fiction, but most, even the cozy mysteries tend to have an untimely death at their core. Yeah.
So how does that affect your daily life? Are you always, do you look at people and think, do you think you could commit the perfect murder, Lori R. King?
like that poor woman who decided to write a story about murdering her husband and has now been arrested and convicted of murdering her husband. You see that? Yeah, you gotta think that most of us writers have more sense than that, but. Nobody said she was a successful writer. So,
well, I'm not saying you are inclined to murder anybody, but do you think you could because you've thought about murder?
Well, I think that certainly a mystery writer who works in modern contemporary mysteries is extremely aware of the difficulty of getting away with stuff. I mean, if I were to be writing only the series of books that I do that are set in the 20s, it's a whole different matter because, of course, forensics is very, very early days there. So unless you leave a blatant thumbprint on something, your chances of getting away with it are fairly high. But 100 years later, when even walking through a room can shed DNA on a scene, you gotta be good. And I think that's one of the reasons why the cold case sort of subgenre is popular, because it allows us to revisit things that they got away with. I mean, one of the questions that that one of my early readers suggested for the discussion questions in the book list is, why should we be devoting our limited police resources to cold cases? And in this book, you've got a cold case that's 50 years old. The chances are that anyone who actually did it has either died or will die before they get through the long and convoluted court case and appeals system. So why should we worry about it? And I think that's a really fascinating question of, you need to know that nobody gives up on you. I mean, as a family, if you lose someone and you don't, it never gets solved, you need to think at least that maybe somebody picks up that file regularly and takes another look at it. And I think that to my mind is the appeal of having a cold case unit in a police department such as the San Francisco Police Department.
Your books often have people in modern day police departments, and in the first book, for instance, of the Kate Martinelli series, I can remember a passage where you discuss what it means to be a police officer. And I think today there's a lot of controversy about police and defund the police and so forth. Yeah. Do you think your books glorify police or I don't know?
Well, I think from that first one, you have a character, Kate Martinelli, who is very aware of how outside she is from the general police department, that she talks about, it's a sort of paramilitary organization. And this is obviously before it literally is a military organization with all the equipment that the US government dumps on them. But even then, most big city police departments are run as the police versus the civilians. And to my mind, I think one of the benefits of the discussion about defunding the police is not that we need to take money away from the police department, but we need to provide alternative resources. I mean, there's no reason why you should call out a SWAT team when you've got some poor person who's off their meds freaking out in the middle of the night. You know, there's no reason to do that if you can send out somebody who has better skills in talking them down, for example. No police officer wants to be responsible for killing someone who is clearly not in control, who is clearly having a mental health crisis. But we don't give them the tools and the backups that they need. I think refunding the police department, that shifting around the resources, instead of just this business of buying armored vehicles for Midwestern towns, is obscene. There's no reason why you would need that. And yet the popularity for it is clearly there. I mean, you hate to see this absolute catastrophe that happened in Uvalde, but you can see how that comes about when you have an organization that is meant for one thing and doesn't quite know how to do another. So, you know, I am pro-police when they are given the right tools and when they have the right training. But they also, the wrong people sometimes end up there.
But never in your books. Have you thought of writing a story in which that is part of it, that the police are wrong?
Well, I think part of this current book, and it is the first in a series, Raquel Lang is a homicide inspector who is seconded into cold case when she's injured. And I think at the end of it, I don't want to go into details again with spoilers.
Right.
But this is clearly a discussion that she's going to have with herself and with others, is how is the police department a valid way of treating problems? And how is it a limited way? And how does a responsible human being make that choice? I've never liked to have a sort of simple villain. And I think that bad cops in fiction can be a simple villain because we've all seen them. I mean, we see them all the time on the news.
Yeah.
And we know why they're there. We know that we should do something about it. But as a main villain in a piece of fiction, they're not interesting enough for a writer to really focus on. It's, you know, it's difficult to make them other than a caricature.
Well, one of the things you do so beautifully in your books is your characters reveal themselves very slowly. I think Sam Spade, we know everything about Sam Spade, partially because of Humphrey Bogart. But I mean, if you just pick up The Maltese Falcon, you can know everything you need to know about Sam Spade in the first couple of pages.
Yeah.
But, you know, Kate Martinelli very, very slowly reveals who she is in the course of your books. How does that occur to you? Do you think of a character, a fully developed character, or are these some of these things surprising to you as you write them?
It sort of depends on the character. With Kate Martinelli, I had a fairly clear idea of who she was and where she was going at the beginning. I'm not an outliner, I'm an organic writer. I depend on the process of writing to really flesh a character out. But it was actually very interesting with this book that Raquel Lang was difficult to get my head around. And I knew her outlines and I knew how she was going to be working, and I knew that I wanted her to have the same mentor as Kate Martinelli had many years before, Al Hawken. But it wasn't until I got all the way through the first draft that I realized that she was just so slippery, that my kind of writer tends to figure that they learn things as they go along and then they'll go through, and the real business of the novel is in the second and subsequent drafts. I always figure that my first draft is a sort of 300 page outline, and it tells me what the novel is going to be when I actually write the novel.
Mm-hmm. But so you're not an outliner, but you are in fact an outliner.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. I just write a very, very extended outline, and I know that there's things missing, and I know that there's gaps, and I, in fact, occasionally will just make a whole chapter that does fill in backstory or, conversation here, because I haven't really decided what I need there, but I know that there's something. But with this one, I got all the way through the first draft, and I let it go cold and picked it up again. And I realized that, in fact, I did not want to give a lot of details about Raquel Lang. That part of what she was, to my mind, was a woman with more mystery than clarity. And it occurred to me as a sort of revelation that this is very, very much like what Arthur Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes is. That we don't know anything about Sherlock Holmes. We don't learn about his brother for years. Watson doesn't learn about his brother for years. We know nothing about his family other than his grandmother was a Vernet and his family were country squires. He went to university, but we don't even know that where he went. So when I realized that, I thought, that's part of what I love about Raquel Lang, is that she is enigmatic and you don't find out a lot of what originally you would have thought you'd need to know about her. And I liked that. I liked that it left all kinds of doors open as well, because some of the stuff, obviously, you're going to have to find out about. But others, I thought I like not knowing.
Do you think that there's four or five Raquel Lang stories that will come and we'll know more and more about her as we go?
Yeah, I think so. I'm already in a sort of verbal contract for another one in a couple of years, so which is nice.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, I think it would be interesting to explore her and her decisions about whether to cop or not to cop, and yeah, her relationships with her equally shady sister and with Al Hawken, who is the very opposite. He is a cop down to his bones, and the excellent kind of cop down to his bones. So, you know, the two of them are pulling Raquel in different directions, I think.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We're chatting this week with Laurie R. King here on KSCO. Laurie King's new book is Back to the Garden.
Laurie King, when you start a novel, do you start with the murder and who did it and then fill out around there in your mind, or does that come to you as you're going?
It really depends. I wrote one book around a title, Monstrous Regiment of Women. I thought that's just too good a title to pass up on. Others I write around a character that I really would like to develop. Quite a few of the Russell and Holmes series have started with wanting to, I send them out of England a lot, because it's always one of the dangers with a series, isn't it? That you end up with with huge numbers of dead bodies in some little tiny
small
town.
Neighborhood, yeah.
Cabot's Cove syndrome. So I tend to send them, they sort of went on a world tour and ended up in India and Japan and the San Francisco and here. Anyway, they sort of moved around a lot, which makes it interesting to the series because you have a whole different set of problems. So that if you go to Palestine in 1919, you have all these interesting problems from a modern set of eyes of where the Middle East problems had their root and where we are today compared with where we were then. You also have the potential for, one of the books is set in Morocco. And so I thought, this is a fascinating time because there's a revolt going on in one end of the country and you have the French colonial government trying to decide how much it wants to commit to Morocco and the other. And these interesting people that I could just sort of make use of. So quite often it has to do with the place that they are going and the people that they would meet there In San Francisco, obviously, you have to meet Dashiell Hammett, because why not? and then the story sort of grows out of that.
I was reading Keith Richards' autobiography, and he tells about waking up in the middle of the night with the idea for the riff of Satisfaction and talking it into a tape recorder at his bedside. And I was wondering, do you ever wake up in the middle of the night with, oh, I've got a great idea for a murder or a great idea for a plot?
I don't tend to have, I mean, I have had a few dreams that have ended up as scenes in books. Mm. But I don't think I've ever had a main character or situation that came out of the middle of the night. More often, my brain seems to function when I'm doing something physically, so that if I'm swimming, if I have a difficult problem in a plot that I just can't figure out how to get it to work out. Quite often, if I go and have a swim, I have a little tiny pool that has a jet that you swim against.
Yeah.
So they're called endless pools, but I call it a mindless pool, because you don't have to think of anything. You just, you know, you turn on the thing and you go.
Yeah.
You don't even have to turn at the end of the pool, because there's no end of the pool. Okay. So it's very satisfying, because it allows you to literally get the body out of the way. And somehow in the back of the head, these little problems will say, but what if you did this? So the key to that approach is to make sure that you have a piece of paper.
Oh yeah, do you carry a little notepad and pencil in the pool with you?
Yeah, and
one, while you're swimming.
One year, my kids gave me a waterproof pad that I could use, oh. which is really great.
Fantastic. Do you have a lot of stories to tell that you know you're going to tell, or do they come to you as you say, okay, here I go, I'm writing? I mean, you have a regiment of writing every day and so on.
You know, I would say yes. I don't think anyone has a normal anything after the last 3 years.
Right.
I am just beginning to get back into the idea of writing after this book, which I finished the first draft in the fall, and then I finished the rewrite in the end of January, and it's now August. So that whole period in between, my brain was having problems.
But all of our brains.
I think that things are beginning to sort themselves out, and I find these odd little ideas drifting through my brain. So.
So there are many books to come, obviously.
Of course, there's always a question of the books that you'd, and the series that you'd love to go back to. And if you live long enough, you're going to get them done. But the fact that you are also in a publishing relationship with a large corporation means that to say, I really love to write the other two books in what I envisioned as a trilogy, for a book that was actually, as a science fiction book I wrote, mm-hmm. that was never published in hardback, only as mass market paperback.
Yeah.
And very few people ever heard of it. But I'd love to write the other two books in that trilogy, because it really, that means the other two. But you think, how many books a year can I write over the next however many years I have left?
Well, how many books a year can you write? I'm curious.
I do one a year. And the last couple of years, I haven't managed to do them in 12 months. I think that Back to the Garden was 15 months after the last book. And I think that the next one, the next Russell and Holmes, will be 15 months after Back to the Garden. So I don't know that I'm slowing down. I think that I just, there have been so many bizarre problems over the last couple of years, sure, both external and internal, that I, you know, you got to give yourself a break. So unfortunately, I have enough, I have enough royalties coming in that I'm not threatened with living in my car. So, so it kind of puts a different slant on deadlines of, if I don't do this, I'm going to be living in a tent down next to the river, or if I don't do this, I'm not going to be able to, you know, remodel my kitchen. Well, I got a sink, I got a stove, it works.
Well, Laurie R. King, your new book, Back to the Garden, I wanted to ask you, the, you were talking about earlier about it being set on this estate, and is that estate real? Is it based on a real place?
It is very, very, very loosely based on Filoli, which is kind of in the same area on the peninsula that the Gardner estate is. It's kind of a similar sort of building and a formal garden in back of it. But that's only because there happens to be Filoli there would anyone even think that they might be linked. But yeah, that's kind of all. I mean, Filoli was never a commune, alas.
Well, artwork figures in this story and in some of your other stories, and you write really beautifully about art.
Thank you.
How important is that in your life?
Well, I think I've known and lived with a number of artists over the years. It's always a discussion about the difference between writing and visual arts, and how closely you can use analogies between one and the other. I think they're awfully different. I think that writing, it's very difficult to compare writing with any visual art form, just because writing is so much rewriting, and an artist would never finish a painting if they had to do as much as I do on a book. Yeah. But I think that obviously creativity comes from similar areas in the brain, and to have the kind of inspiration that obviously is at the base of either a piece of art, visual art, or a piece of prose, that comes from a similar area in the brain.
Well, it's always an interesting feature in when it shows up in your work. Your new book is a lot of fun, in addition to being, you know, a murder mystery, and I really enjoyed it, and I think everyone will enjoy it. And it's called Back to the Garden, and the author, the brilliant Laurie R. King, thank you so much for visiting with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Aaron. I really enjoy talking with you about anything.
Well, I hope you'll come back and chat with me again.
Okay. Take care.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.